please can you remind me, if you'll be so kind, staring out into space, asking God to hear my case, trying to think of all things past, how long will my memory last, the purple angel. Well, hi everyone, and welcome to Alzheimer Speaks Radio. I'm your host and founder of Alzheimer Speaks, Lori LeBay. And I don't know what it's like in your area, but in Minnesota, we finally have a little rain, and it's cooling off and feeling like fall is moving in to capture us here really quick. For those of you that are new to the show, I just like to give people a little bit of history about Alzheimer Speaks. We're an advocacy-based company providing multiple platforms to shift our dementia care culture from crisis to comfort worldwide. And we believe here that by joining forces and sharing knowledge and just having these everyday conversations about life with dementia, that we can remove the stigma attached to memory loss and help those living with the disease continue to live with purpose. Together, we can help everyone understand the true needs and remove the myths and the isolation that is created for so many families and friends living in our communities. At our core, Alzheimer Speaks believes collaboratively we're going to win this battle, and I know that we're making a big impact here on our platforms, and that is due to you. All of your likes and clicks and shares are making a huge difference. You're getting information out to your sphere of influence. And the more information that is readily available, the more likely people are going to grab it and run with it and tap into it when they need it. And that is such a critical, critical piece of this disease. The denial, as we know, is so heavy. So I want to thank you each for helping us get that information out to the people in need. You can always go to our website and get more information on our blog, our webinars, which is called Dementia Chats, where our experts actually are living with the diagnosis. Here on the radio show, you can go to the resource directory, our YouTube channel, or get our free tools, all at www.alzheimerspeaks.com. Also, for anyone out there who has a story about dementia, maybe you're diagnosed, maybe you're caring for someone with dementia, maybe you have a business that is helping those with dementia, or you've written a book or a film or whatever it might be, how are you advocating? How are you making the world better? Let us know. We would love to hear from you. We're always looking for guests, and Alzheimer Speaks is about raising everyone's voice. So please join us and letting us know your story. I always like to also give a shout out to a few special organizations that are really dear to my heart. First, I'd like to mention HealthStar Home Health, an amazing company here in Minnesota. They're going to be at our state fair. They're going to be doing memory screenings for the second year in a row, which was absolutely unbelievable last year, the contacts that they made. And they're also helping us launch a beautiful film called His Neighbor Phil, which is absolutely the most realistic film I have seen to date regarding living with dementia and what families go through. So visit them out at the Care 11 building, right off of Dan Patch and Cooper. Again, that's the HealthStar Home Health booth. And you'll be able to get a memory screening if you're interested, resources on dementia, as well as learn more about this film, His Neighbor Phil. I would be amiss if I didn't talk about Alzheimer's Disease International. They are the association of all Alzheimer's associations around the world. So not only can you find the association closest to you, but you can also find out global information and research that's going on. There are also different types of dementia like Lewy body and frontal temporal lobe, vascular dementia. So search information on those specific sites as well. And aphasia, which has to do with speaking. That association has some wonderful tips on how to interact with someone who's having some speech problems. And there are heavy needs for trial and research. So check out the Alzheimer's team on Facebook, or again, you can see one of their graphics right on Alzheimer Speaks homepage. Click on that, take a short survey, and see if you might be a ready candidate for one of the clinical trials. In order for us to find a cure, we have to be able to do these trials. So they are a critical piece. Before I introduce our first guest, I do want to give two shouts out to the Twin Cities Hit Show, which is an online radio show broadcast right here in the Twin Cities on Alive and Social, Monday through Thursday at 9:30. And each day you'll hear hilarious commentary about the latest news from your host, Rusty Gatenby. He's a comedian with Chuck Gallup, and they do and say things on the local morning show that can't or won't, you know, you won't normally hear. So listen in and learn. They do a lot. They just do a great job. I was able to sit in when I first came over to a live and social on their show, and it was just really fun and very, very upbeat. The other thing I want to do, one last shout out to, is Apples to Apples. And Apples to Apples is a sports show featuring the father and son team of Scott and Drew Applebaum. And find out if father really knows best. Visit aliveandsocial.com and hear this fun and lively little banter every week between Apples to Apples. So with no further ado, let me introduce our guest here today. Some of you are probably familiar with Anthony Cirillo. He is extremely well-known, especially here in the U.S. Did you know that there's almost 40 million people at the age of 65 and over in the United States? And in America, 50 and older population is going to reach over a million this year. These are statistics that flow easily off Anthony's lips. He really fell into his mission and his advocacy working with the elderly when he started performing in nursing homes. And he has turned into this passionate advocate that has done just a lot of advocacy, volunteer work, research, training, speaking, and entertaining to seniors and caregivers alike. And he helps lead them through life on his platform of Educated Aging, which covers physical, emotional, and financial levels. He's a gifted singer and performer, and he's been in Nashville, and he's sung all around the country, and he uses his performing gifts in his keynote speeches and press engagements. He's really an experienced leader in the healthcare industry and one who knows how to navigate the industry as a whole. He understands the seniors and the caregivers' perspectives and their needs, and he's just a really bright light in terms of helping them live with dignity and purpose. So welcome, Anthony. How are you today?
I'm great, Lori. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm thrilled that you have taken the time out of your day to be with us. I always like to start out asking each one of our guests if they have been personally touched by dementia, either, you know, via a friend or family member.
Yes, and so I am a family caregiver for my mother, and she has all her cognition, but she lives in an independent living community where there's others of her friends who I've been able to, my mom's been there about, maybe 18 months. My sister passed in January 2014, and we moved mom up here. And I've noticed a lot of her friends who I first met have been declining over time, and it's kind of an interesting thing to experience and watch. And, you know, it really does call to the fact that no matter what the setting of care, and I know the general consumer a lot of times puts all of these groups it under one umbrella, but that you can find dementia, Alzheimer's at all levels. And so my closest has been kind of observing mom's friends. But my wife's family has experienced some dementia and Alzheimer's with her aunts, or one aunt particularly died from Alzheimer's, and of course my work through the Dementia Action Alliance. I've just made some great friendships with people and have been able to witness it firsthand.
Wonderful. Anthony, can you tell our listeners, how you became involved in elderly issues and what you're trying to achieve with your business?
Well, I was a healthcare professional back in Philadelphia, so I worked in hospitals and healthcare, and pretty much, still is a big part of what I do. But it wasn't necessarily, it might intersect with seniors now and then, but it wasn't necessarily a senior mission. But I was also a lifelong entertainer, and as you alluded to in the intro, kind of semi-professional. But you kind of get tired and burned out on nightclubs and that kind of living, and I went into a nursing home one day and started singing. And when I left Philadelphia, I was actually doing 100 performances a year part-time. And it really just crept up on me that I was getting a lot of fulfillment, but also giving a lot of fulfillment as well. But the interesting thing that happened was that, when I was in a band, I was just a performer. I was just a singer and a guy who played an instrument. When I went into nursing and assisted living, I became a performer. And there's a nuance there, because I became a performer because of the people who I were entertaining. And so I learned pretty quickly about wandering and things like that. And so when people would, a person in the home would come up to me mid song and be there, at first you're not quite sure what to do, but over time you learn to accept them where they're at and to embrace them, and if they want to stay up there for the whole program, so be it. And so it really has, and I've learned so much from elders just from the performance aspect, and so over time I've kind of developed this, as you mentioned, this platform about educated aging. I'm really an advocate that people need to prepare for aging sooner in life, that it comes down to three areas, and you really need all three. And the first is your physical health. How you take care of yourself, when you're younger, is going to impact how you age. I talk a lot about, I go into some places, and people are there not because age caught up to them, but they didn't keep up, with their own selves. And so that's one piece, but then you can't have that without understanding how all this is paid for, and there's enough financial professionals and others who talk about that, but I talk about it as in a combination of things. And so, there's so many misconceptions about how things are paid for, and even with increased levels of people putting into their retirement savings, which is great, they're thinking they could use that for cruises, and they may need it for their health care. And then what I call emotional aging, and we may cover that a little bit later, but it's what are these things that I've learned from elders about living a quality life as you age, even in the places that the general public most associates with death. And so you can learn so much about their resiliency and their ability to bounce back. And, you learn those types of lessons, it's going to serve you well as you get older.
Definitely, definitely. Now, you have on your website a video about Esther, and kind of, how your mission with elders was really solidified. Can you share with our audience that story?
Sure, and it's a big part of when I speak. So Esther, when I first came down to the Carolinas, so I'm originally from Philadelphia, moved down to the Carolinas 14 years ago, and as I was starting my own consulting business, I was kind of also going and entertaining, because obviously you start a new business, you're a little slow in the beginning. And I went up to Hickory, North Carolina, and I met Esther. And, Esther, I tell people, became my designated heckler for my shows, because every show is different. And when I every month I have a different theme, and some of it's obvious and some of it's not. So Memorial Day, you might do, the traditional military salutes and things like that. But in November, I'll do a song like Pennies from Heaven, and Esther would ask, what's that have to do with anything with November, Anthony? I said, well, it's National Accountants Day. And, of course, your listeners are probably rolling their eyes, and Esther was rolling her eyes. And so, obviously, over time, we became really fast friends. And so one day, the activity director asked me to go visit Esther in the hospital with her after a performance. And so I didn't really think anything of it. So the performance was done. We went over to the hospital. And on the way, the activity director said, oh, by the way, Esther's in the coronary care unit. She actually died and was revived a few days ago, and she wants you. And, of course, I'm thinking, oh, Lord, what's that all about? So we get there, and Esther's there, and her daughter's there, and Esther starts flirting with me mercilessly, much to the embarrassment of her daughter. But Esther wants one thing for me, and she wants me to sing for her. But she doesn't just want any song. She wants a beautiful song, Because He Lives. Because He Lives, I Can Face Tomorrow. Except there was one problem, as I told Esther. I said, Esther, I don't know that song. I said, I'm from South Philadelphia. I said, and when we come down our steps in the morning, we have a picture of the Lord on one wall and a picture of Frank Sinatra on the other. And I said, I sing those types of songs. And so I sang, eventually got around to singing Unforgettable for her, and she was unforgettable. But I said, I'm going to go learn that song, and I did. And I have a little studio, and I mixed up a CD, one CD with that Because He Lives, 3 minutes, one song. Sent it over to the assisted living. She was back there, and I pretty much thought all was well with the world. But then a few weeks later, Sherry, the activities person, called me and said, "Oh, Esther's in hospice." And then it was a short time after that Esther had passed away. Now, I don't necessarily make it a habit of going to funerals of people who I've interacted with in different settings, but Esther's was calling me for some reason, and I did go to the funeral. And when I walked in, of course, the song on the program was Because He Lives, and Esther's daughter came up to me, and she started crying, and she hadn't cried up until that point, and she told me that, and others told me that, and she said, did you hear about my mother's last day of life? And I said, I didn't. So evidently what happened is that her daughter played my CD with Because He Lives over and over and over again. Eventually her daughter, knelt down next to her mother and started singing in her ear with me on a recording and telling her to let go. And Esther died that day. And, I tell people that, and we've had conversations offline about this, that even as challenging sometimes to be an advocate and on a mission, and sometimes you say, man, am I getting anywhere? Am I doing anything? And you have doubts sometimes, but all I have to do is be pulled back to, and there's more stories of Esther like that, and I'm sure in everybody who's in this field. But for me, it's like, all right, Esther's looking at me. I still have her thank you card for making that CD on my desk. I'm looking at it right now. And so every once in a while you pick it up, and you just can't run away from this even if you wanted.
Wow, what a powerful story. And I can imagine that's one that will never, ever leave you at all.
Never.
To know what a difference you've made in someone's life, and then especially at the end of life, not only with the person passing, but with their family, an incredible, incredible story. I'm going to shift gears a little bit to something a little more up, though I think that is just so touching, and I think it's such a gift to be able to be with someone at the end of life as well. I know for many it's a very scary thing, but I've had the privilege of being involved with a few people, and it's just it's a phenomenal experience, and one that I will always remember, each and every one that I've been blessed to be with. But I'd like to switch over to, you have written a book, and one that kind of has a funny title called Who Moved My Dentures. Can you tell us about that book, and what is that all about?
Well, essentially, it was a total offshoot of my singing. So I was meeting all these wonderful people in all of these places, and they all had a story. And so I wanted to write a book that told their story, but at the same time dispelled myths about aging, whatever they might be, like general conceptions that, these are places where the mentally ill are, or whatever, fairly high-level consumer perceptions that are probably still out there. And so it became a human interest story, a book of human interest stories that dispelled different aspects of aging, caregiving, healthcare, whatever it might be. And at first the title was just a cute play on words because, there's that cheese book out there. But I logically backed into why that title absolutely made sense, because the cheese book was about resiliency in the workplace. And every single one of my stories was about an elder or elderly couples in some cases who faced a situation where they had to be, resilient and figure out their life situation. Obviously, if they were in assisted living or nursing home or were adult daycare, wherever I met them, obviously there was something that changed in their life. and they had to bounce back from in order to live a quality life. And the people who I wrote about obviously led a quality life and just illustrated some of the more positive things that you can about living in the places, again, that most people associate with going to die. And so that's kind of, it was just cute, being a marketing guy, a cute title that was catchy, but then actually made sense when you thought about it.
That's a great and interesting story in terms of, you know, how you moved music into a book and connected with people's stories and stuff. It's and it's a fun, catchy title too for people to be able to relate to. Now, you've done a lot in terms of training and trying to shift culture and stuff, and you explore like 13 different myths about long-term care facilities. Can you talk a little bit about those myths? Because I think that that's a great topic for our audience. People are always interested in what if we have to make a move? What do we need to look for? What do we need to know? Because we don't even know where to start.
Right, and there's certainly enough advice books out there, and with healthcare becoming so more transparent about how to find, look, and maybe even evaluate, and we can certainly get into that. But these are more high level types of things that I surface. So, for example, and some of it's just a mindset culture shift, maybe. So, the first thing is pretty obvious, but these are places that you go to live, not to die. And there is a woman in the book, Jean, who went into a CCRC, and she walked in and thought, wow, this looks like a hotel in New York. Now, we know that the wallpaper is not indicative of the quality of care, but nonetheless, she was looking at going in with optimism, with the glass half full. And this was a mild-mannered housewife who was widowed young and raised her sons and kept to herself, and she blossomed in this place because she participated in all the activities and just really found herself, and repurposed herself at a time when most people said, you're going there, well, see you later. So that's certainly one thing. And another thing, I explore lots of different things. I mean, one thing that is kind of an interesting subject these days is sexuality and aging and, the ability to couples to live together in these places, but also for romance that happens. I mean, my mother is in an independent living, and you kind of witnessed what happens. And it's kind of cute, but it's also a very serious issue. I mean, there's been cases, I didn't write about this one, but I certainly heard about it in the news where, for example, a son walked into a room and his father was engaged, so to speak, with somebody else in the facility, and the son kind of freaked out and took his father out of the assisted living. But what was interesting about all that, when I talk about this, is that the woman who did absolutely have dementia also started deteriorating after he was removed from there and went somewhere else. And it really gets to, I think, even in Still Alice, I think one of the last things she says is that, when all else is gone, there's still love. And obviously there was still love in this woman and a loss that was felt, and she became depressed and dehydrated. And so not many people think about sexuality and aging unless they're making snide jokes about it, that kind of thing. So that's another one. And you could certainly tell me when to go and stop here. But, friendship, that's another thing. And, I really think with all of the settings of care shifting, and they certainly are, it's so dynamic anymore about where people are getting care and nursing homes becoming like hospitals and assisted living becoming like nursing homes, that I think as much as people talk about aging in place and all of the things that you can do to do that, from the home monitoring to home health care to telehealth to whatever it might be, retrofitting your house and all these things, I think the one thing that all of these places offer is the idea of the social aspect and the friendship. And, one of the reasons my mom lived with my sister in Florida, but when we brought her here, I mean, we didn't physically have the first floor set up for her to live with us, but we also said, you have 150 friends at this place, and certainly that's you know, something that is really needs to be accounted for when you're looking at this, because you know, my mother-in-law, who is in fine health, but she's close to 85 and just lost her husband, is still living in the condo she shared, and she's very isolated. Now, they have a big family, but they don't always get there, and so she's in many ways more isolated than my mom, and so there's really a lot to be said about the friendship value, no matter what your cognitive ability in these places. So that's another one I explore. Obviously, you're familiar with activity professionals and all the things that they do, and I think people think that there's nothing to do in these places, and then if there is something to do, it's about they throw you in front of a TV or it's bingo, and in reality, because I write for About.com, I have one person who writes for me about activities, and she's constantly surfacing these best practices that people are doing, either how to develop one-to-one activities for people, or the, you know, more and more, we, of course, being a musician, I'm in tune with the memory and music and all the different things that go on there. So there's really a lot of things, and it's becoming more person-centered and person-directed as we move to a culture where we get to know the person who's coming in and be able to kind of tailor activities. So that's kind of another thing. I touch a little bit on abuse issues, but you know, I think there's, you know, it's not as prevalent maybe as it was before, and that's because a lot more, again, transparency and all kind of other touchy issues in nursing homes with you know, cameras and whatnot. So we talk about that, and I hit on the finances a little bit, because I still think people think Social Security or Medicare are going to pay for, you know, your care if you need this advanced care, and you know, Medicare kicks in maybe for 100 days if you're hospitalized, but other than that, if you're not saving and you know, or getting long-term care insurance, which is harder to get and more expensive to get because few people are buying it, you know, that's you really need to start, you know, when you're saving for in your 401k, you really also need to be saving about, you know, paying for your health care part of your retirement, because you might have Medicare, but it's not going to pay for the long-term care.
Yeah, very interesting. You know, we use the term, you know, aging in place, but maybe it should be living in place, or living in peace even, in terms of, you know, that peace and comfort, that even if someone is moved outside the home, they still have that right to that peace and comfort of which we call home. And that comes in a lot of different angles, from being active to just relaxing and absorbing some downtime. But I think it's a real critical piece. I also think that, you know, long-term care, as scary as it can be for a lot of people, some of the advantages are that social interaction that we as family members cannot give. We're a spouse, we're a child, we're a grandchild, we're a friend. But we're not necessarily a peer. I guess a friend would fall into that category, but family really doesn't. Even though I can say my mom is my best friend, it's a different dynamic than a girlfriend, you know, or a spouse would have. And so, you know, for me, I remember the very first time, and my mom lived in a nursing home for 14 years, the very first time I walked in, and I was just about brought to tears by an activities director doing a very simple activity of just sharing a really colorful magazine and letting all the residents reminisce. And they were so engaged, and I never would have done that as a daughter. And even if I did, it would have been different. And I saw the power and the beauty of that, of the peers and that social interaction, and I think that that's really important for people to remember, you know, if a move is going to take place. Would you say that you're pro or con against nursing homes? And I know that that's kind of a loaded question.
Well, I'm more of not of people realizing don't lump all this into one. So, you know, when, you know, my friends, you know, and I'm a boomer, and if you talk about these issues, I mean, they just talk about going to the home, you know, and then it could be nursing home, assisted living. They don't make a distinction. And I think it's more about, is the setting of care appropriate? And we certainly know that In independent living, there's probably people who need to be in assisted living. In assisted living, there's probably people who need to be in nursing homes. And again, the dynamic is shifting. There was a New York Times article in April that basically the headline was nursing homes are becoming hospital-like. And of course, we know that they're offering rehab services and things like that. But more of the care is being pushed out of hospitals, and readmissions are a big issue. And in hospitals and nursing homes play a part in whether people go back or not. But, I think it's more about the setting, because then more acute people are, I've witnessed this, in assisted living, are in there inappropriately. Now, some places are, licensed to be able to take care of these different levels, but a lot of times they're not. But they're kind of hanging on to these folks because of various reasons, financial and otherwise. So I think it's more about the setting of care. And I think, again, I always circle back, you can have all of the services, brought to you in your home. And you read about Uber getting into senior transportation and all these types of things. But I think unless you live in what they call these NORCs, naturally occurring retirement communities, where all of your friends kind of are still around and all the services kind of come to that community, and it's more in big urban areas in New York and things like that, you're going to miss the socialization part. So I'm really more about, is it the right setting, and are people there, for the right reasons in the appropriate setting?
Good answer. I like that answer. I think so many times people fall either in the black or white scenario, and it's so much more colorful than that. Especially with all the choices that we have now when it comes to care. Now, I know that one of the things that you're starting to talk about now is going into hospitals and helping them become dementia-friendly. And can you tell [S2] Sure. [S1] Us a little bit about your work with that? I know Gary LeBlanc has his wristband program that he's doing with some hospitals, but I think yours is a little different.
Yeah, and that program is just a great program. So, because I've worked on the hospital side for a long, long time, I'm looking at it from a few different aspects. And again, this is about some of the movements that are going on in healthcare that I think would benefit readers. I mean, with hospitals, again, a lot of hospitals own, at least in the areas that I consult geographically, own their physician practices. And with the shift in healthcare happening the way it is, they talk about physician practice being certified medical homes, and it's kind of a good descriptor, the home where, this is the central hub where you're going to get your care, and this is where you kind of report back to and get your guidance, at this medical home. And they talk about issues like population health management, where you get a chronic disease category like congestive heart failure or diabetes, and managing that with a team that's focused on it so that you can be well, obviously in a changing scenario where you don't get reimbursed for everything that you do, but for the quality that you produce, that's a win-win on both sides. But as I wrote in a recent blog, that I don't think dementia, including Alzheimer's, is a fit in the population health medical home, because obviously there's no cure. And so the folks there, until a person deteriorates to a point where they're then manifesting other healthcare conditions, then they fit into that nice, neat population health model. Oh, now we can get them in here. And so I think, now I was talking to a physician yesterday at a hospital I'm consulting with about kind of the gaps in care in their medical homes. And this was a pretty robust set of practices that are all certified medical homes. It's a big achievement. And I mainly reason their quality is kind of ramped up. But they had done no kind of dementia-friendly analysis of the whether health, their communicate or an environment or pretty much anything that way. They've just been focused on moving into this new phase of healthcare and reimbursement. So I think that's one nuance, is that it really has to start in the physician offices, and we need much more education in the physician offices about these types of issues. But then as you move into hospital or any business for that matter, but we talk a lot in the hospital space about that the patient experience begins with the employee experience. And so if you have employees who are engaged and in the workforce and happy in their in their jobs. And of course, we know the amount of burnout, especially in the long-term care side, and the shift and the need for continually replenishing the workforce, that if you have happy employees in some respects, you're going to have probably a better experiences for the people you're taking care of. And one of the things, nuances I'm trying to explore is that, what if we looked at, you know, caregiving in the workplace as a kind of road to improving employee experiences, because 6 out of 10 people in the workforce are family caregivers, and the latest AARP NAC study actually said 25%, which I was surprised, are millennials. And so this is a big issue, and it's actually a societal issue that we have to talk about. And there's groups like REACT, Respect the Caregiver's Time, that are popping up, where major companies like Pfizer and CBS and the Cleveland Clinic are saying, we're stepping up, we're going to recognize family caregivers, we're going to start, you know, trying to destigmatize this, because I'm sure you talk a lot about, you know, when somebody is diagnosed, they're all, you know, automatically, you know, Richard Taylor, God rest his soul, that recently passed, talked a lot about, you know, once you're identified, you're put in a box and you're stigmatized. And so it's the same with the family caregiver. So I think we have some work, if you're talking dementia friendly, about, and the employee piece is that. And then I think from a hospital point, you can get to all of the process improvements, the tactics like patient family advisory councils, and, you know, does a state have the CARE Act so you can start documenting the caregivers more, and, you know, patient portals and being able to communicate better. But I think you have to start with culture and, you know, what is the culture toward older people. I wrote a blog for, I think it was caring.com a few years ago, and I talked about age bias in terms of, you know, the normal things we think about, somebody's getting slower or their hearing is going. But I talked about something from Princeton University that they labeled kind of prescriptive prejudice. And it was the idea in three areas that people have these prejudices, succession, that people should move aside, older people should move aside from higher paying jobs to let young people take them, so to speak. And the idea of identity, older people should not attempt to act younger than they are. And the third one was consumption, that seniors should not consume, and this one just kind of really irks me, but seniors should not consume scarce resources such as healthcare. And if you go in, what I tell, you know, when I'm consulting, I tell people, you know, how you perceive is impacts how you care, and how you care impacts how people talk about you. And that's word of mouth, and that's your brand, and it's all related. The experience is the marketing, and so it becomes also the revenue. And so these are all important issues, and, you know, a lot of this can start just with in the language you use and the marketing, and yet these are departments that, by and large, are staffed by very young people who don't have as much appreciation for maybe some of the issues that come with aging.
I would agree, but I also think our younger population is really watching their parents and identifying what they will and won't do in the future, and they're really sticking to it. And they're going to be, I think they're going to be a really force to reckon with, which I think is great, because they don't want to work, you know, 10 zillion hours like so many of us boomers do. You know, they want to have a life too, and I've also seen them care very consciously, but they do it in a different fashion. I think they're smarter about it, and they want more balance with it. And I think that that's something that boomers kind of gave up on, and didn't find that balance quite so well. So I think it'll be really interesting in the workplace how that shuffles out. And I don't think it's anything that any one company should ignore. This is a huge, big force. Caregivers is the largest group we've ever had to deal with, because everybody is a caregiver. There's not one of us who is not in some fashion. It's just when it's really going to hit home and challenge our ability to perform at our current level, you know, we'll make the difference there. But we're all choosing to care, even if it's not one specific person who happens to be ill. It's how are we interacting with our families? How are we interacting with our friends, with our coworkers, with strangers, with our clients? You know, they're all choices, and we have forgotten that those really should be conscious choices. and not just automatics there. So I applaud you for your work in trying to get people to move beyond that kind of customer service mentality and really get person-centered based in their care culture, if it's in healthcare or a different work environment, understanding that everybody is really impacted by this. One of your programs is really about being person-centered care, and I don't know if you want to talk about that a little bit more, about obstacles and opportunities in terms of shaping our care culture, you know, for aging care.
Sure, and getting back a little bit to the whole culture of customer service versus resident-centered, I mean, a lot, especially more transparency in long-term care, there's these CAHPS surveys, these surveys that you get when you go to the doctor and somebody will send you a survey to fill out, and the hospital's the same way. You know, there's kind of a couple camps that, with my work in patient experience, and you sometimes find out that some are just chasing scores. And so, big thing in hospitals is noise reduction. You know, so we have to reduce the noise to get that bigger score so that we're graded better and we look better. And so it's more about following the rules. And sometimes we get into cultures where, we map the experience ad nauseum and then we script responses. And, you know, there was a telling quote from Toby Cosgrove at a patient experience conference in Cleveland. He's the president of the Cleveland Clinic, and he said at one of the conferences, the real measures of patient experience come from the heart and really knowing people. And so when you talk about kind of intake into assisted living or home health, I think it's about following some of the examples out there that are getting to know the people better. And so, I cite in some of my presentations the Living History Project from a woman named Sheila Brunet, where volunteers actually go and, talk to people about their life story. Now, I think, obviously, there might be some challenges with dementia and Alzheimer's patients, and maybe family caregivers need to participate in that. But all of that is about helping to get people who are caring to get to know them better and understand some of their backstory. And I think sometimes we miss backing away and simplifying some of our approaches. I attended a patient experience conference locally, and it was the three of the healthcare systems there. And then somebody had actually turned out to be an incredible idea, because when you first looked at it, you said, what's this guy doing here? And it was a franchisee from Chick-fil-A. And you said, okay, what's he got to do with patient experience? But what he talked about was he called it the core four things that they do at Chick-fil-A that you are sometimes overtly aware of and sometimes not. And, two of them are pretty easy. Make eye contact and smile. So that they're easy. But the other two, the first one was assess the situation. So somebody's, and I give the example of, in the spring, the little league teams are playing, and they're after the game is over, there's a winner and a loser, but they're all getting treated to Chick-fil-A, and they come in, and you kind of sense from how they're acting, maybe how the situation worked out on the field. And so accordingly, you kind of can say, well, what's my approach here? And then the other thing he talked about was maintaining the relationship. And that meant, if you go into a Chick-fil-A, and it's my one vice of fast food, somebody will greet you invariably. And if you dine in, so to speak, somebody will probably come over. It might be the same person who waited on you who will clean up your table, even though we're quite capable of, throwing the trash out. But as you're leaving, somebody will say goodbye. And if you look back, it's probably the same person. And that's what they mean by maintaining the relationship. And this isn't in a fast food service that essentially, doesn't, its product speaks for itself, because the lines are wrapped around the corner and any Chick-fil-A I've seen in my area. And so, but they're simple types of things. And when I talk about changing the culture of aging care, I talk on a 50,000 foot and then work your way down level, because I'm all about connecting the dots between, there's so many silos. So hospitals operate in silos. Within hospitals, there's silos. But you look at the whole continuum of care on the long-term services and support, and starting from adult day to home health and hospice, there's silos within silos. I mean, there's two or three different industry associations just for the nursing home assisted living, and each has their own agendas and competing priorities. And so, you know, sometimes you have to, step away and say, how are we all working together, and look at some of these big issues. So certainly language that we use and the marketing and the media that are, you know, out there and how they portray elders and caregivers and people with dementia and Alzheimer's. And, I talk a lot about caregivers and the statistics around them and family caregivers in the workplace and the stigmatization of them and how we need to kind of, look differently at that. And I also talk a lot, and this is something that I don't think a lot of my healthcare colleagues are understanding. You know, when I was talking earlier about population health and medical homes, there's also something in healthcare called accountable care organizations. It's the idea that there's going to be lots of different entities partnering together to offer care so that it's more seamless, that the transitions are better, it's more coordinated, and eventually move to, you know, one payment. They call it a bundled payment, where you'll get a bundle of money, and usually the hospital will be left up to their devices to then split it among the other providers. But most of those experiments have been hospital to hospital, other hospitals that they may have been competing with or cooperating now, or hospital to physician, or hospital to, in very rare cases, the nursing home. And we have a great opportunity, the long-term care industry does anyway, to broaden the discussion because, you know, have you ever thought that the partner in the care is the bank teller or, you know, the people at the supermarket? There's a Bloomberg article about how bank tellers are becoming, caregivers on the front lines of Alzheimer's because they're seeing the behaviors, and especially if they're educated around it, they're seeing things happen before anybody else does. I went to health affairs briefing, I think it was last year, on the issue was the long tail of Alzheimer's, and there was a medical ethicist from Penn there, and he talked about his own father's diagnosis and the fact that the first time they figured out that something was wrong because the guy was messing up his checkbook. And so we don't realize that there's unlikely partners out there who we need to enroll, and these are going to be partners that we're not thinking of readily, at least in the health professions. And so I think there's just a lot of thinking that has to be done and walls that need to be broken down. I mean, starting dementia registries and then, dementia friend programs and things like that. So, it's a general discussion to get people wrapped around that this is all connected, and this isn't just a healthcare issue, it's a societal issue.
I agree, and I think people realizing, where do people spend their time? Like in the grocery stores or the banks or the gas stations or the restaurants, those are the people who are really noticing the symptoms and can help and want to help, but they need some guidance. And we also have to get families to start talking openly about this because we're in such denial, especially in this country with this disease, called dementia, and then people get offended if somebody tries to help because, oh no, that's not us. And so we really have to stop looking through, rose-colored glasses and stop being ashamed or feeling guilty. And, a lot of us as family caregivers are trying to be dignified be respectful to the person diagnosed when actually we're harming the type of care that they could get because we're trying to hide it, where they could be treated even better. They could get better service if we were honest. And we haven't looked at it through that lens. And I think that's an important thing that we need to do. I can't believe we're almost running out of time here. We've got a little over 5 minutes left here.
Wow.
So
where did that go?
I know. Time goes really, really fast. You do a keynote entitled The Meaning of Life, and you have kind of 8 points in that program. Can you share with us a little bit about that program?
Yeah, I'm actually giving that next week for the Alzheimer's Association of Charlotte, and I'll be the ending keynote. But I talk about, and again, it's just fascinating as I look back on my career. This all, again, spawned from singing to the book to the speech because it's really taking all the things I've learned. So I talk about the fact that You know, what can we learn from elders about living a quality life at the end of life and from elders who are in the places of gnosis associated with death? I mean, that's kind of the thing. Because if they're doing it, then we can be doing it. And the first thing I talk about is purpose, that they still have some kind of purpose. I talk about a woman named Ruth Ann who president of the residence council. What a thankless job that is. But she did all kinds of other things in the place. And when I was interviewing her, she said, I pray to God for what my purpose is in life. And I just found that fascinating, because here you are at 85 and you're still searching for purpose. And I tell family caregivers that, and including myself, I have to remind myself that you have a great purpose. You are in a great purpose right now, and you should realize that. This is an opportunity that you're only going to have probably once, and that, you know, you need to look at it that way, but also that you need to take care of yourself, and you need to keep your own dreams and wishes alive, because you're not going to be a caregiver forever. So that's kind of point number one. I talk about, again, every point has a story, a psalm that goes with it, and then a study that I found that somehow backs up, you know, the point. So obviously the value of activity, and I talk about the blue zones across the world where people live to an older age and some of the things that they exhibit from this idea of moving naturally, not necessarily have to get on the treadmill this morning. It's just, can I build movement into my day every day where it's going to help me? That's a direct offshoot from the blue zones is, the whole idea of friendship and socialization, and the fact that there's been studies around all of this that show that you can actually ward off and at least maybe delay and at least live better with Alzheimer's and dementia if you have social networks, if you've had social networks, you know, earlier in life. I talk about lifelong learning. I talk about a protest group called the Raging Grannies that are out in Seattle, who have nursing home and assisted living folks in their group who help them write parody songs. And so I said, you know, it's all about keeping your mind sharp. I talk about the power of humor, and that in many ways the humor has the same benefits of exercise. And I'll have the crowd next week trying their best to do rock and robin and tweet and flap their wings like birds, and we'll give prizes. It should be kind of interesting. I talk about a great attitude, unconditional love, but I think probably the most important point I think that we can learn is gratefulness. And I dwell a lot on that you know, the rate of depression in this country is like 9.6%, and in Nigeria it's like 0.8%. They're struggling for food and water, and we're engaged in this what some people label existentialist despair. In other words, we worry about things we shouldn't really have any reason to worry about. We need to, you know, be more grateful, and that's kind of how I end my day every day. I go to bed and I think about three things that I'm grateful for that day. Obviously, this will be one, having been a guest on your show, and other things that I'm grateful for. And I think if you can maintain gratefulness, and that's what I certainly learned, because I met enough people who are in where you say, there by the grace of God go I, that if we were in that situation, where half their body's paralyzed, and yet they come up to me after a show and say, you know what, I look forward to every single day to get up and live my life. And it's like other people have just the opposite and say, I just want to die. So that's a gratefulness is, I think, of all of them, that's the most important.
I agree, and I think that that's something that we don't talk about much in this country. I think Oprah kind of brought it back, in the spotlight again, and living in the moment and appreciating what we have instead of, you know, crying over the past, what we feel we lost, or crying over the future for what we think is coming. And, you know, we lose so much time, so much valuable time, and everyone will agree, you know, that we don't have enough time in a day, so we can't waste it. And the more we are grateful for, I think the more great things come our way with
great.
That. So, well, wonderful. There, you have so many different websites and stuff that people can go to reach you. Do you want to talk about the different social media platforms you have and what people can find on some of those? Because you've got some great great video and stuff out there. One of them is the robin, you know, when you get them tweeting and,
yes,
flapping and stuff.
So I have a YouTube channel, and if you got, I think, you know, until I can consolidate, I am in the process of rebranding, and my main website will be called theagingexperience.com, and people can go to that now to redirect to some of my current consulting site. But I have a blog that will roll into this new site, but right now it's called educatedaging.com, obviously just like my platform, educatedaging.com, and you'll be able to click on each one of my social networks from there, but you'll also read my daily blogs that have, you know, just different information about different health studies and different things I encounter that can help us all just be aware and live a better quality life. And there's videos attached to those, but then it leads to all my social networks as well. So, you know, I think you go there, you're going to pretty much find that. When it goes to another site, it'll redirect to that.
Okay, well, wonderful. Thank you for taking so much time with us today. It's really been a pleasure and an honor to have you on the show, Anthony, and we wish you the best of luck in the future, and keep up the great work.
Lori, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it. It was an honor to be on your show.
Thank you. For those of you that didn't listen to last week's radio show, I would encourage you to do so. We had the cast and some of the crew from the new dementia film coming out. It's going to be launched on the 27th, so next Thursday, called His Neighbor Phil. It was really kind of fascinating talking with some of the actors and the director and figuring out how the script got written and how the community of Zumbrota, Minnesota got behind this film, along with certain sponsors. Next week on the 25th, I'm thinking we might do, I'm not for sure on this, but we might do an open mic. I haven't done one for a while, and that might be kind of fun to do. On the 27th, I will also be out at the State Fair, so please stop by and see me at the Minnesota State Fair. Again, I will be at the HealthStar Home Health Booth in the Care 11 Health Building just off of Dan Patch in Cooper. And we'd love to see you out there. Again, you'd have an opportunity to not only be interviewed, if you'd like, and tell your story and how you're affected by dementia or caregiving. But you'll be able to get a lot of great resources and even get a memory screening if you'd like, and then find out more about the film and where it will be. Our last Dementia Chats was on the 11th, which was, again, very interesting conversation. All of our experts are diagnosed with dementia. We talked about sleep issues, and that is recorded. That's on the website at Alzheimer Speaks. You can find it still on the homepage. Otherwise, you can always go to the About page for all the past sessions. And our next Dementia Chats, again, those are all free, will be coming up on the 25th. And that'll be 11 o'clock Eastern, 10 Central, 9 Mountain, and 8 Pacific Time. And that's 4 o'clock if you're over in London. On the blog, what do we have there? There's information about Richard Taylor's memorial. It's going to be online, and it's going to be on the 19th. And there are times posted for all around the world, but I'm just going to note the times here for the U.S. So it looks like Eastern Time is at 5:30 p.m., Central 4:30, Mountain would be 3:30, and Pacific Time would be 2:30 then. But again, if you go to the blog, and again, you can get to the blog from our website as well on that. Want to, again, do one last shout-out. I'm thrilled to be with Alive and Social here. And don't forget to listen to Apples to Apples and the Twin Cities Hit Show. And again, come on out to the State Fair on the 27th between 12 and noon. I'd love to see you at the Care 11 building. Until next week, have a blessed time. Thank you.